Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Today, my guest is Renee Denfeld. She has a brand new book called The Butterfly Girl. It is a really tight psychological thriller that you guys are going to love. Before we talk to Renee, let's hear from some sponsors that make the show possible. Jasper T. Scott. His box set, Dark Space, the complete series. This is 6 books bundled together on sale now for 99 cents. 6 complete books, over 600,000 copies sold, more than 2,000 pages of epic space opera for the low price of 99 cents. Also available in Kindle Unlimited if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber. Humanity is defeated. 10 years ago, the Scythians invaded the galaxy with one goal: to wipe out the human race. Now the survivors are hiding in the last human sector of the galaxy, Dark Space, once a place of exile for criminals, now the last refuge of mankind. The once galaxy-spanning Imperium of Star Systems is left guarding the gate, which is the only way in or out of Dark Space, but not everyone is satisfied with their governance. Freelancer and ex-convict Ethan Ortain is on the run. He owes crime lord Alec Barandi 10,000 souls, and his ship is badly damaged. When Barandi catches up with him, he makes an offer Ethan can't refuse. Ethan must infiltrate and sabotage the Valiant, the Imperial Star System's fleet carrier which stands guarding the entrance of Dark Space, and then his debt will be cleared. While Ethan is still undecided about what he'll do, he realizes that the Imperium has been lying and putting all of Dark Space at risk. Now Brondi's plan is starting to look like a necessary evil, but before Ethan can act on it, he discovers that the real plan was much more sinister than what he was told, and he will be lucky to escape the Valiant alive. Grab all 6 books for 99 cents right now. Dark Space, the complete series by Jasper T. Scott. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. Survivor, Mother, Leader, and Humanity's Last Chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Edge of Valor, a military sci-fi thriller by Josh Hayes. When their mission fails, his begins. David Weber calls it a tour de force. Special Agent Jackson Fisher is a man after truth. When a military operation to extract a high-ranking ambassador from the war-torn border world of Stonemaier ends in disaster, Fisher is called in to investigate. A whole platoon went in, but only 3 Alliance Marines returned home. The rest killed in action along with hundreds of civilians. With tensions between the Holloman Alliance and Stonemaier rising, Fisher attempts to stitch the pieces together. One thing becomes more and more certain: the surviving Marines are lying. As the truth unfurls, Fisher begins to realize this was far more than a simple rescue mission, and that the truth might be something best left buried. Filled with action, mystery, and well-crafted characters, Edge of Valor, the Valor series book one, will put you into a world of war, conspiracy, and betrayal. It's perfect for fans of David Weber's Honorverse or Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan with a futuristic flair. That's Edge of Valor by Josh Hayes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Renee Denfeld on the show with me. She has an amazing new book. It's called The Butterfly Girl, that will absolutely rock your socks off. This is an amazing book. Renee, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, wow. I grew up in a great deal of poverty. I come from a real hard knocks kind of background. And from the earliest of age, almost kind of a pre-memory age, I loved books. And my family actually used to joke, I thought it was something that was actually made up, but they joked that I was reading and writing by the time I was two or three. And I actually found a family picture, which I put up on social media some time ago, where there's actually a picture of me as a toddler. I'm with one of my brothers, and I actually have a pencil in my hand and some paper, and I look like I'm busy trying to write something. So the family story may have turned out to be true.
It's something I
loved escaping into story. I've loved books since as long as I can remember. And I always wanted to be a writer. But to be honest, for a long time, I felt like somebody from my background couldn't be a writer. So I think it took me quite a while to finally get to the point where I had the confidence to write fiction.
Wow. What part of the country did you grow up in?
I grew up in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. That's not a place that we normally, or outsiders like me who are not from Portland, that's not a place we usually associate with growing up in poverty.
No, it's not. There's this very common vision of Oregon as this kind of utopia. but actually, Oregon, I won't go into the history too much, but it's a very much a working class, blue collar kind of background. It was a timber state. Nowadays, there's a lot of poverty with the dying timber towns. There's a lot of poverty, was and still is, in the cities. It's just not something we commonly see depicted about Oregon. But I actually grew up in the Portland, Oregon, in what used to be called the ghetto in the 1970s, which is a very poor, very rough area of town here. And, it just was a really hard scrabble life, but it also brought a lot of beauty and a lot of experience, which turned out to be very influential in my fiction as well.
So being from this background and having this feeling that this was not something that you could do or were supposed to do, what did you choose to do career-wise and to pursue in life?
Well, by the time I actually was a young teenager, I actually was homeless. That's the kind of background I came from. It was, very difficult, grew up with a lot of abuse as well as poverty. And so by the time I was a young teen, I was actually living on the streets of downtown Portland, and I spent all my time in the public library. And I used to actually go in. I have such vivid memories of going in the library and climbing the wide staircase and staying there until the place closed. And I would, make stacks of books around me on the table. And so, when I was able to finally get off the streets, I actually did a lot of service work. I think my first job was at a McDonald's, and I'm a humble person and from very humble background. So I ended up actually going into some freelance journalism, which was really good for me as a writer because I learned a lot of craft. I started working for very small alternative newspapers, the kind that actually would only pay me like $10 for a record review, for instance. But, for those who want to take that kind of route, writers, I do, really suggest looking into doing some form of journalism, even if you want to become a novelist, because there's so much craft you can learn about structure, you know, about how, you know, to build a narrative, how to tell a story. And I think the best takeaway I had from doing freelance journalism was I learned to write on a deadline. And so, you know, you learn you can't procrastinate if you have a deadline.
Yeah. Well, and there's something about having your confidence boosted by someone wanting your words and willing to pay for them, even if it's $10. Because, you know, the definition of a professional is someone who gets paid for their work. And even if it's $10, you're a professional writer. And that does something for your confidence level that nothing else can.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you said that, because I think it's so true. You know, I remember seeing my name, my byline, for the first time, and it was in a scrappy little kind of alternative newspaper here in Portland. And I had gotten paid $10 to write a record review. But just seeing my name there, it was profoundly validating. And there was this realization like, hey, you know, I can be a writer. So getting out there, you know, when I'm mentoring aspiring writers from backgrounds like my own, I often suggest to also, you know, get out there, write essays that are published online, you know, even if it doesn't pay well, get that validation and that experience, because it does really make us feel like, hey, yeah, we can do this.
The idea that your teenage sanctuary was a library, I guarantee just made so many people happy that are listening to this. You know, we've all probably been guilty of throwing around cliches, you know, like, oh, this book changed my life, or this book saved my life. For you, that was probably quite literal, that having that place and surrounding yourself literally by stories probably saved your life in a time or two.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the library, I you know, was my sanctuary, and I see it as it's a true democracy. The library is a place where stories and, you know, welcome people, and it doesn't matter, you know, and that's true of all books. You know, books are a place where everybody is welcome, and it doesn't matter what tragedies we've experienced. It doesn't matter what mistakes we've made, because we've all made mistakes. You know, books are this place where I think we have a community, and people like yourself, and I'm very thankful for you, because you bring that community together, and we have a place where we can meet each other and talk about story and how it connects us. So actually, at the end of The Butterfly Girl, and The Butterfly Girl actually features a 12-year-old street girl who also finds sanctuary in the library. And, you know, I wanted to thank libraries in particular, because I think that, you know, that's a place where so many people from, you know, tough backgrounds can find a sanctuary.
Right. Aside from your journalism work that you began doing, you also have served as a chief investigator for a public defender. How does that twist and turn in your story take place?
Well, you know, what had happened was, so I went into freelance journalism, and, you know, I'm somebody, just to be honest, I don't have a formal education background. My formal education actually ended in the 9th grade. But I like to joke to people that I got my free MFA at the public library.
Yeah. Ray Bradbury.
Yep. You know, and actually it's worked for so many writers.
I mean,
Yeah, the MFAs are a pretty new invention. You know, for generations, people learned to write by reading. You can learn so much just by reading. And, you know, I particularly recommend reading and reading and then, you know, rereading books as well. So what ended up happening was I became a freelance journalist, and I was very disciplined. I worked really hard. I ended up climbing up the career ladder and freelancing actually for places like the New York Times, where I was an investigative reporter. And I think my background gave me a lot of, you know, benefits and skills that way. So I'm not afraid of other poor people, and I'm perfectly comfortable going into areas and places other people might be, you know, worried about. So I'd done that for quite a few years. And by the way, I'm hoping my dog doesn't start barking.
We don't mind real life here. It's all good.
Nope. This is a real life home in here. So I had done that for quite a few years. And in the meantime, I actually became a foster mother as well. And I began taking in children also from difficult backgrounds. I had adopted three kids from foster care when the bottom pretty much started falling out of the journalism industry in the 2000s. And I was kind of casting about for a different kind of work. I wanted to do something where I felt like I was really making a change and helping people from backgrounds like my own. So I actually ended up taking my skills as a journalist and an investigator, and I got a job at the Public Defender's Office here in Portland, where I ended up becoming a chief investigator. And I've actually, until very recently, was still doing that work. I've worked hundreds of cases, including death row exonerations, working with sex trafficking victims, all sorts of work. And the interesting part to me was, you know, I started doing that because I wanted to make a difference, but it has had a profound impact on my writing as well.
Well, you mentioned a minute ago about getting your MFA from the public library, and lots of authors have given the advice that if you want to be a good writer, you need to read a lot and you need to write a lot. You know, find out how it works by reading others, and then, you know, work it yourself until you get good. And I like to add a third component to that, and that's get out and talk to people and see what life looks like, and, you know, watch people, watch how they interact with others, listen to how they talk. This sounds like the work that you've been doing is like a writer's dream for soaking up, you know, the kinds of stories that you tell. Could you do the kinds of things that you do if you had not had the background that you've had?
You know, honestly, I think it's been a real asset, because doing the public defense work is a lot like being an investigative journalist, but kind of like that on steroids. You know,
lives are on the line.
People's lives are on the line, and it's my job to find out what really happened. And for a writer, being given this kind of gift of the job of finding the truth, I mean, that's just an astonishing thing. So as an investigator, I spend a lot of time not just in jails and prisons, but I will go out and I'll find somebody's kindergarten teacher. I'll find a witness that disappeared and is now living homeless under a bridge somewhere. Not long ago, I spent months trying to track down a sex offender who had disappeared, and I ended up finding him living in an abandoned car way out in the boonies outside in a small decaying timber town, you know, that was outside the woods someplace. And so, you know, it's just astonishing as a writer because I get to experience and hear all these stories, you know. So it's just like what you're saying. I mean, I think it's not enough, you know, we need to read a lot, we need to practice our writing, but we also have to find the stories that we're kind of meant to tell. And the only way to find those stories is to get out there in the world and to experience it in some way or another.
Well, and the books that you have written, The Enchanted, last year's The Child Finder, which was an amazing book, by the way, and this year's The Butterfly Girl, you know, knowing more of your backstory now, I can see the connections with you personally and why these books resonate so deeply, because this is something that not only are you passionate about, obviously, but it's something that you've lived, and you can connect with these characters in a very deep way, which means me as a reader gets to connect with these characters in a deep way because you become the conduit between those two things. You know, and it's impossible to look back on life and think about, oh, you know, those hard times I had, I'm actually thankful for them now because they led me to this place. And that's something you can almost never process when you're in the midst of it. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of stories you write, what motivates you, and the feedback that you've gotten from readers for allowing them to connect to stories that maybe they never could have because of the kinds of books that you write?
Oh, of course. You know, I I feel like I want to take you with me on book tour because you put it so much better than I can. You know, I think
Thank
it's
you.
so, yeah, it's so true because, you know, life is hard sometimes and life is difficult for all of us. And, you know, I don't think there's some sort of hierarchy of struggle. I mean,
Sure.
we all experience grief and pain and loss. And
Our struggles just look different sometimes.
Absolutely. You know, one's not worse or better than the other. And that's the magic of stories is we can all relate to, you know, we find out, oh, other people have suffered. You know, other people are experiencing these things. And, you know, so when, you know, we're talking about like how we find those stories we need to tell as writers, you know, I think whatever we connect to personally, you know, I've read, you know, just amazing novels that the plot line actually might seem kind of plebeian or kind of ordinary, but the writer is able to bring this insight to the story. And that's what matters. And so, yeah, I feel like I have this opportunity and I just feel blessed, to be honest, to be able to tell these stories, because a lot of times I'm telling the stories about people who live really difficult lives on the margins of society. And there's a lot of, you know, myths and stereotypes out there. You know, like, for instance, a lot of times when I've read books that feature homeless people and homeless kids, I've thought that they, you know, sometimes depict us and people like myself in a negative light. And so I feel like I can, you know, bring a lot of humanity and insight into these characters and have people, you know, it'll help people understand what it's like on the other side. And that can only really be a positive thing. You know, but what actually really touches my heart is I get so much positive feedback from readers. And it's not just people who have, for instance, been homeless. A lot of times it's people who have experienced other tragedies and other difficulties in their loss, maybe, you know, their life, like maybe they just went through a terrible divorce or they just lost their mother to cancer. And they resonate very deeply with the themes of survival. And a lot of my books are about not just how we survive, but how we heal and how we recover and how we move on from those tragedies.
Well, and before someone gets the wrong idea that your books are these deep character studies and important things that we need to you know, look at about the way other people in our society live, which they absolutely are, but that's not all your books are. Your books are highly entertaining you know, mysteries and thrillers. The new book is the Butterfly Girl. You know, actually, I mean, just kept me on the edge of my seat. I had to know what happened. And when you start thinking of a new story, you know, and the most boring question to ask a writer is, where do your ideas come from? Because, you know, ideas are everywhere. They're all around us. But there is something special about that idea that floats a little higher than the others and shines a little brighter. And you just, as a writer, you look at that, and you say, ah, there's something here. When a new story starts coming to you, like The Butterfly Girl, for example, how does it begin to develop for you? What is the kernel of that story? Where does that come from?
Well, you know, what you're saying, I think, is so true. And, you know, it's not enough to just have insight. You know, it's very important to me that I create books that are page turners. And, you know, I don't want the reader to have to wade through 50 pages of, you know, Renee's musings about life. you know, the reader, we read stories because part of us does want to be entertained, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. We want to feel, I think a better word for it is we want to feel captivated. You know, and when I'm reading an exciting story where I stay up way too late because I have to know what happens, I mean, what's more delicious than that? I mean, that's just, you know, that's the best of everything for me. And so that's my goal as a writer, is to have these characters, to have these insights. But also it's very important to create the plot that makes the reader turn the page, that sense of suspense. And so when I'm looking, you know, when a new story idea comes to me, like The Butterfly Girl, right away, when I'm thinking about it and developing it, what I like to do is I take my dog for very long walks every day. I have a big, I'm looking at him right now, a big dopey Great Pyrenees. And I'm sure you can tell when I'm working on book ideas, because I walk really fast and I mutter to myself. And, you know, I'm thinking also about, okay, I want to have a story involving a 12-year-old street girl. And I know that there is a killer that's operating on the streets. And this is also inspired by real life events here in Portland. And a killer is killing these street girls. And so I know that that's right away, that's going to be my storyline. But I do a lot of thinking and planning. And I also sit down, and I like to draw out my plot ideas, which I'm happy to talk about. I sketch a lot. I sketch the locations and I kind of draw timelines about what's going to happen so that my story has some shape before I start writing and I know where it's going to go.
It has some literal shape to it as you're drawing it out.
Literally. And actually that's a technique that I just kind of came up with. It really works for me. And I have a giant sketch pad and I sit around, I draw a little figures for the characters. And mind you, I'm a terrible artist. So we're talking about stick figures with bubble heads. But I draw the location and the landscapes. And if people are, say, going from one town to another, I draw the roads. And this all seems quite goofy, but it lets me see the physical landscape of the book so that I can make sure that the pages are going to turn. You know, there can't be dead space on the page. There always has to be something happening in the story so the reader is captivated and wants to turn the page. And actually drawing it out physically helps me with that process.
I did that for a story that I wrote one time. We got these end rolls of paper from our local newspaper that when they would get toward the end of a roll and there wasn't enough paper on this roll to do another run, they would swap it out. And you could buy these end rolls, and it was probably 50 feet of paper left on it. And they'd sell them for a couple bucks to the public. And so when we had little kids, we would buy these rolls and would spread them out on the table and do art projects and stuff like that. Well, I had this idea, and I started sketching, like you were saying, that the story out and characters and having them go from one place to another. And what I discovered is that I can take notes on a sheet of paper with bullet points and little things that that trigger something for me. And that's all well and good, but sometimes I look back on that and I have trouble recapturing that emotion that I was thinking about around that. But with that drawing, and the same thing happens with music for me, is I can get back to that emotional connection of that place. Do you have an experience like that?
Yes, I do. You know, and it's interesting because when you were just saying that, I found the same thing too. I can make copious notes and notebooks with bullet points and numbers, and they don't always stick in my head the same way that, you know, I still work on the butterfly girl. I don't even need to go look at my sketchbook. I still can vividly see the figures and the maps I drew. So I, you know, it makes me wonder if there's a different part of our brain that kind of registers this, you know, where, you know, or maybe it's just the act of drawing the landscape or, you know, creating the figures, you know, it takes it out of the realm of just word ideas. And you actually then have that kind of more cinematic imagination for the story. I wish I could have some newspaper rolls like that. That would be amazing.
Ask your local newspaper if they have those.
Yeah. I don't know if we have a local newspaper anymore.
Yeah. We barely have one. So
yeah, it's really a shame. Yeah. I'm more afraid that somebody's going to discover my awful sketch pad and drawing. I actually keep it hidden behind my desk out of fear that somebody will see what a terrible artist I am.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. Tell us about the character of Naomi. Who is Naomi and what is happening with her that brings us into the story, the butterfly girl?
Well, so Celia is the 12-year-old street girl who is currently living on the streets because, like a lot of homeless children, her home is, you know, is very unsafe. And So she's currently homeless, which is, you know, I think an important issue because it's, you know, there's so many homeless children right now. And so there is a, as I mentioned, there's a killer who's been killing the street girls in the town, in the city. And meanwhile, Naomi is a young woman who is an investigator. And people call her the child finder. And Naomi actually has a very significant history herself, as she was kidnapped as a young child and held captive and then escaped. And so she brings her own, not just her own passion into the work, but her own insights into what it's like, not just to be missing, but her own insights into the kind of people that take children or the kind of people that harm children. And so Naomi is actually brought to the city because she is looking for someone. And her paths collide with Celia, the street girl. And I won't give away any of the plot stuff from there, but it's very much a, you know, a story of threat against, you know, the potential threat of what could happen to Celia, as well as the investigation that Naomi has to conduct to try to find the person she's looking for, who may or may not be a victim of the man who is killing the street girls.
Wow. The subject matter, it can be so raw. Do you ever, when you get into a scene and are writing it, does it ever just emotionally overwhelm you? And how do you deal with, you know, when you start talking about writing, stories about children, and, you know, that can be very, very touch and go emotionally for a lot of people. Do you ever think about that? And when you're writing those scenes, how do you kind of navigate those emotional waters?
Well, that's such a wise question, you know, cause I do think about it. I think we should. And, you know, my basic rule is I think even fictional victims deserve dignity. And yeah. So, you know, for readers out there who might be considering picking up The Butterfly Girl, I want them to know there's nothing graphic in my work. I don't want people to feel traumatized reading about crimes against children. And, you know, as somebody who myself has survived a lot, you know, I don't want to traumatize myself. And I would be horrified if I ever felt that I, in some ways, I'm trying to think of the right word, that I was vicariously using violence. And so I'm very delicate and very sensitive when I'm writing scenes that might go that direction. You know, I think about the fictional victim and how I want to preserve their dignity and respect. And I also really keep in mind that, you know, I want work that, you know, entertains people. I want work that captivates them. I want work that maybe helps people and gives them insight and a feeling of, you know, something redemptive. You know, I want people to leave the story feeling better than when they started the story. And so, yeah. You know, I kind of keep all those things in mind. And I really appreciate you asking that, because I think as writers, you know, it's very important for us to protect the reader in the sense of, you know, helping the reader and respecting their boundaries at the same time.
Well, and it's such a powerful story, because, you know, at the end of the book, I am left with the feeling that I have developed more empathy for these characters and for characters like them that might be around me in my world that that maybe I haven't opened my eyes to in the past. You know, there and redemption. I'm glad you brought that. It's such a powerful, resonant undercurrent in this book, and it's not the we don't get the feeling of or I didn't that I just feel sorry for these characters constantly, you know, an oh poor pitiful character, but I find myself rooting for them and wanting the best for them. Other than empathy that we, you know, build from reading stories like this, is there something that we can do in our own communities to maybe make a difference in these kinds of stories?
Oh, you know, thank you. And I'm you know, that's something I thought about doing my work. You know, I think, you know, I don't want people just to feel sorry for my characters. I've never wanted anybody to feel sorry for me. I feel like I have this amazing, happy life where I've gotten to take challenges that I experienced, and I've gotten to help other people with them. And I'm actually, you know, I consider myself this very joyful, very optimistic person. And so I know that if people, you know, people, for instance, hear that I was on the streets and that I was trafficked, you know, I don't want them making assumptions about me and who I am. You know, and part of our society, it's interesting to me because I think sometimes we take certain people in our society, and certainly a message I've gotten a lot is that I must be broken or I must be damaged. And I don't feel that way at all. You know, I feel like I'm just as innocent as I ever was. And, you know, so that's a message I think I carry into the book. And, you know, so when, and I've already hearing from a lot of people that have read it and they've said, oh, my, this is, you know, it's thrilling. It's, and, you know, captivating, a page turner. I was absolutely blown away that I've gotten all these, this fantastic early praise from the likes of Margaret Atwood and Mary Kubeka, all sorts of writers. But also people, I think, are leaving the story with, you know, maybe their eyes a little bit more opened to the plight of homeless children and homeless people in their areas. And, you know, so I think one thing I would add to that is, you know, I think there's something we can all do. I mean, certainly not everybody's going to go out and become a foster parent. Not everybody can and not everybody should. But, you know, there's I'm a firm believer that we can all make a big difference in the lives of other people. And I'm also a firm believer that most people want to make a difference and most people want to be good. And there's so many things that we can do that might seem very small to us, but actually are life-changing for other people. And, you know, it can be just as simple as volunteering at your local school or checking in on that family down the street where the single mom is struggling and offering to help her out sometimes. Or just, you know, being aware of the kids in your own neighborhood and how some of them might need an intervention and help. And, you know, those little things we can do, I think sometimes can make the most profound difference in other people's lives.
Well put. The Butterfly Girl, as you're listening to the show, today is release day for The Butterfly Girl, and it's out available everywhere in hardcover, Kindle edition, and audiobook. You really need to listen to the audiobook. It's amazing. You can get an Audible sample at the Amazon page for it, or at audible.com. Renee, this is such an important book. It's such a an emotional book, and I learned so much from it. But you know, at the end of the day, I was really entertained by it. You are a master storyteller, and at the end of it, I wound up learning something, and I think that's the best thing. I was entertained, and I feel like I came out a better person at the end. So thank you for writing that. If people are just learning about you and want to get connected with all that you do, is there a place they can find you online?
Oh, yes. And thank you so much for those compliments. That made me feel really good. So thank you. Yeah, online, I'm on most of the social medias. My kids help me when I'm I don't know what I'm doing. I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I also have a website. So please, if you're out there listening, come make friends with me. I love talking to readers and aspiring writers and helping other people. So come find me on Facebook or Twitter, Instagram, or on my website. It has a little email button too, as well as more information about the book.
Thanks, Renee. We're going to send everybody to pick up a copy of The Butterfly Girl. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode, and we'll put links where people can connect with you as well. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Oh, it was totally my pleasure. I think I'm going to go walk the dog now, so thank you.
Thank you to Renee Denfeld for joining me on the show today. Be sure to check out the links to her work in the show notes of the show. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dream coat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
She'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whorls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.